So why do you think it's important for this world to have great writers?
Oh, on so many levels. Okay, so number one, if we're talking fiction, great writing is a door into humanity. I think we could all use, I think Jamie Ford, I was interviewing him recently for a podcast, and he said that his most recent novel, The Many Daughters of Afang Moy, was to inoculate people with empathy. I thought that was a great way to say it. But fiction increases empathy. Like, it's proven. You enter into the human experience. And I think we need great stories, great writing, to expand our horizons, to step in each other's shoes for a little bit, to walk roads.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of You're Probably Okay. I'm so excited to host today's guest, Catherine Ray. Catherine was a history major at Northwestern and is a proud Notre Dame parent of two daughters. She most likely will find this podcast interview to be a walk in the park, as she is rarely lost for words. That's because Catherine is actually a best-selling author who is on the verge of publishing her 11th book this March. Catherine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited. This is our first author, and probably going to be the best one we ever get.
And probably your first non-alum.
It is, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
lovely
good.
To be here. As I said, I've got a little bit of legitimacy with two daughters on campus, but I kind of wish I was a Notre Dame grad myself, but that ship has
pretty cool.
Sailed.
Yeah, Northwestern's pretty good. Well, we usually start these off. We start these conversations kind of getting a better understanding of why our guests chose the schools and majors that they did. Except I think with you, I want to go back even a little further because before you were even in school, you were debating in front of the Supreme Court.
Oh my gosh, this is so much fun. You've just aged me.
So tell me a little bit about that and then how you eventually ended up at Northwestern and why history. I mean, that's kind of wild.
Okay, so I was a high school senior in 1988, which was the bicentennial of the Constitution. And there was a competition, a national competition at that time for AP history classes. And you would debate the Constitution at the district level, then the regional level, then the state level. And if you won your state as an AP history debating team, you got to go and debate in front of a truncated Supreme Court, meaning not all nine justices. I think we had, you know, rotations of three justices. And so I was part of the Michigan team, and we went and we debated in front of three justices of the Supreme Court. We did not win. I think our state came in top 10, but that could be revisionist history. I might be making that up or just aging. But yeah, that was really fun. I love history. Absolutely love it. I love studying it, what it says about, you know, human nature and the human experience, but then also how it applies to today. I've always said there really is nothing new under the sun. Anything that happens today, we've seen echoes of it from the past. And so you have to know your history. And so when I went to Northwestern, which was a very mature decision, I simply followed my brother. Anyway, but it turned out to be a great school for me. I majored in history and loved it and thought I would go on for a doctorate at some point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. And I thought you told me you had a concentration even in sociology?
Yes. Undergrad. Sociology is my concentration. We didn't have minors at Northwestern.
That's kind of like how it works here. When I'm with Lucy and somebody asks what she's majoring in, I sit down because it's going to be 10 minutes.
You want to hear the whole spiel?
Yeah.
So I'm double majoring in anthropology and global affairs. Within global affairs, I have a concentration in global policy, and I have minors in business economics and computing digital technologies with a concentration in UI UX.
Okay, so how is that possible? Yeah.
That was longer than your last book.
Exactly.
Longer than your last book.
Remarkable. That's all I can say. Remarkable.
So, Catherine, you've told us that you couldn't write the stories that you are writing now at 22 years old, and I thought that was a really loaded sentence if you really think about it. So there's many students in arts and letters that are aspiring to be future writers and study their crafts and be better storytellers. And when they graduate college all ready to go, the only problem is they don't know what to write about. So can you tell us a bit about your career before you became a writer and how that led you to the job of your dreams?
Yeah, and I think that is something important. We say, you know, in the writing world, you write what you know, but that does not actually mean the physical experiences. Like, you can write about a serial killer and hopefully you have not had that physical experience. But it is about what you know emotionally. That is sort of the basis. And at 22, sometimes it's actually hard to know what you know emotionally. I went into marketing. I went into digital marketing, database marketing for years. And then I worked in nonprofit development for the Field Museum and then for the University of Chicago. And so I didn't actually start writing until I was 39. And I didn't publish my first book until I was, I think, how old was I? 43. And so it definitely is a second career for me. And I could not, as you said, I could not have written the books I write now for two reasons. Number one, I did not have the life experience for the kind of story I like to tell, the kind of story that resonates with me. And then another thing, quite frankly, I didn't have enough experience in human pain. And I know that's a really difficult thing to say, but pain is universal. Whether you've lost a family member or your job or you've just, you know, broken your leg or something, it's going to heal. We have empathy and sympathy for each other's pain and that universal experience of suffering and the joy that can come from it, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't know enough about life to write what I write now back at 22.
It's very artful.
And that's what, when we were talking a few weeks ago, I just remember you talking about how I see it all the time, and I'm sure Lucy has felt it, and some of the students who helped put on this podcast have probably felt it, is when you're here at Notre Dame, there's a lot of, it's not necessarily pressure, but it's just this theme of you're going to go create good, you're going to go have a ton of impact, you're going to go change the world, and then you're 19, 20, 21, and you're like, I don't know what that first step actually looks like, though, and am I a sellout if I actually just go into a regular job? And your point is you're not, and it's actually okay to do that and work on your thing on the side. And
absolutely, not only is it okay, it is great to do. I have to tell you, as I said, I have a master's in quantitative marketing and I worked in the marketing world, and my books have numbers in them. Like, they are very literature heavy books, and yet I'll have an engineer in it. And that is part of my experience of working with engineers. And it's just all of these things come in that soup of creativity. But not only that, all of these things come into that soup of being that person who is making a difference in the world. You know, we always say we want to make big differences. Well, think about all those small differences we make every day that have this incredible ripple effect. So I don't think we should ever denigrate the little good things we do on a daily basis. They matter.
That's awesome. And I have a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout your entire career, did you know that you wanted to be a writer? Like, did you always have that in the back of your mind, like graduating college, this is what I want to do, but you know you have to do these life experiences first?
No, that would mean that I actually had a plan. I always loved writing. I mean, you can't be a history major. You know, everyone says, well, were you an English major? I'm like, well, history majors write a lot too. That said, I actually thought I would be a history professor. Then I actually went back for a master's in theology and thought I'd end up being a seminary professor. I did not finish that degree. But point being, I always loved to write. I never thought I'd write fiction. I always thought I'd write nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And then a fiction story came to me and I just started to write it and the ball started rolling. And I love fiction. I love the power of fiction. But I would not have been able to tell you that 20 years ago that that would have been my path.
That's amazing. I also love historical fiction. So.
I do too.
Before we talk about the writing though, I want you to share, because when you look at your background, first off, this ages me. So I'm 38 now, but I remember the Sears Big Book because I remember being a kid at Christmas, and the Sears Big Book, like 60 something pages of it was toys.
Oh yeah.
And you worked
with
the
big book.
So for the youngsters listening to this, tell us what the Big Book was.
Okay. So the closest I think today we have to the Big Book is Restoration Hardware's catalog. I mean, I don't know. I get this thing in the mail and I'm just like, you are wasting so much paper, but it's like 2 inches thick. Well, the Big Book was the original massive catalog, and it was probably 2 to 3 inches thick. And it was Sears, Roebuck & Company. It had been out for like 100 years. But the point is, when I graduated with my master's degree, the Big Book had just closed. So I am aging me right now, because that was the most robust database pretty much in the world at that time. It was like, I think it was over 55 million, which sounds like tiny, tiny numbers these days when you look at Twitter and Facebook and everybody else with the databases they have. But anyway, so that data was aging. And so we had to use that data and sort of parse through it and find out what products might interest different customer segments. And you don't want that data to get too old. So it was a very fast thing, you know, figuring out how to appeal new products, make new products that appeal to new customers.
And then, again, before we move on to the writing piece, which everybody's excited to hear, funniest story from the field museum job.
You're going to make me tell the bug story.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the bug story. So, little known, the best way to get muscle and everything off bones is to let little bugs eat it, because you can pull the bugs off the bones of a skeleton and the cartilage is still there, so your skeleton can still have integrity and hold up. Whereas if you do it chemically, you can get through that cartilage pretty quickly. So the Field Museum does have a bug room where they take fossils, etc., and they clean bones. Well, one year for the women's annual, like, might have been the Christmas tea, somebody opened the venting system from the bug room, and the whole museum reeked. I mean, those bugs smell really horrible, and it was an interesting experience.
Because they're eating dead, like, carcasses.
Yeah, they're eating dead carcasses. Oh. And, you know, there are gases and smells that come off the bugs and the carcasses and everything else.
And
you do not want that
fancy
ladies
tea.
You do not want that floating through.
So, but without that experience, you wouldn't have been the writer you are today.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all because of the bugs.
There you go. Alright, speaking of the writing, so this is the part I want to dig into. I'd love for you to talk about your writing career a little bit, learn more about your process, insights on the business. And I guess we could start with, I recall you tell me when you wrote your first book, you signed a contract immediately to write two more. And I had asked you, did you have two more ideas? How did that feel? Because that's kind of wild.
Okay, so yeah. One thing is, I have friends who have ideas in a folder. They have so many notebooks full of great ideas. That is not the way I write. I am a one idea at a time person. I'm all in on that idea. I can't even think of another idea. So when my debut novel sold, it did sell within a three-book contract. And also another thing about the debut novel is you always hope it will sell. You hope it will get off your computer. But you don't know that it will. So you really are writing for yourself. And it can take you as long as you want it to take, or as long as it needs to take. But then all of a sudden, you're under a deadline, and you have to produce a new novel within, my deadline was a year. I had to produce a new novel in a year, and I wasn't even sure I knew actually how to write a novel. I had stumbled into the first one. So needless to say, the craft books came out, how do I do this job? And I love my second novel, the sophomore novel. It turned out to be something I still cherish, but.
And when you follow up to that, when you're writing, I guess for lack of a better term, you just know when it's good? You get a good, pretty good feeling like this one's going to be a good one.
Yeah, you do. Because there's a certain, and it takes a long time in that process. The idea at the beginning can be great, but any writer can ruin a great idea. But it's that end process where you're like, okay, the magic happened. The magic, dust was sprinkled on it. It just came to life. And that is this sort of magical moment, a synergistic moment where the story gets beyond you just a touch. The characters come to life, they get their own voices, and it just sings.
Can you talk a little bit about that, actually? Because I've asked you about that. How do you keep track of all the characters? What's your prod? Like, how do you just keep track of a story?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm a very tactile visual person. A lot of writers I know keep everything within, say, Scrivener or a writing program on the computer. I do almost all of that development work on paper. In fact, when I start to map out characters, it is colored pens and a stack of, just normal printer paper. And every character gets these, color arcs and their journeys. And then I write out different scenes by hand first so that emotionally they create more resonance within me. Then I will go to the computer. But I'm very tactile at first because that's how I will get to know things better, is if I sort of have hands-on. So it's a mess. I'll tell you, all my research actually is in notebooks. I mean, it's an absolute mess. But what that means is when I need to find a simple fact, I've got to page through that whole notebook, which means everything else is getting into the soup that I was talking about.
It was funny. You were saying, when Lucy and I were talking to you a few weeks ago, you were saying that if you're writing about, who's your favorite character right now that you've written?
That I've written?
Yeah.
At the moment, Anya.
And Anya lived in what year?
Anya was born in, Anya's basically mid-80s Moscow.
Okay. So you were saying this great, back to your history background, was you needed to know what was going on in the 80s in Moscow to know how Anya might have felt.
Yeah.
So that's a great, I think it's a great endorsement of, to your point, no, I'm not an English major, I was a history major. It's why I'm a great writer. You know, you got to know what was happening.
You got to know what was happening. Because when you write a story, when you're writing a story, you are not telling a series of facts or even a story per se. You are telling how it affected your protagonist. A story is an emotional journey. So I have to know not only what happened to Anya in the mid-80s in Moscow, but how she felt about that. You know, what she was seeing, her worldview. We're all subjective. We all carry a worldview. Well, what was Anya's worldview? How did all of the events of her life affect her individually? And that's what readers connect to.
I actually never realized how empathetic writers have to be able to literally put themselves in someone else's perspective. I don't think I've appreciated that as much.
Because that's what you carry away from the story. Yeah.
That's amazing. And I know you talked about how authors are like artists, and how even in like your own writing, you always are switching it up, like creatively. That's the word.
I was a comms major, so nailed that one.
Thank you, Jared.
Anthropology.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit more about why you switched around in writing and how you knew it was time to change directions.
That's an interesting one. So yes, my first few books are very literature allusion heavy, almost homages to Jane Austen and the Brontes. And then I pivoted a little bit to just more of sort of a love letter to books, a couple books in that way. And then I pivoted to historical fiction, switched genres, which not all publishers will let you do, but I sort of ventured off that way on my own. And now, at the moment, I'm writing historical fiction that entails spies, which is so much fun. But after my next book, which publishes in March, I will leave spies behind. I'm going to go to the art world. And part of, to your point is that it really is like what excites me, what's next. Writing is a creative process. And I said before, I don't think that, say, an MFA should be put in the English department. I think it should be put in the creative arts department, because it is this incredibly creative process. And if you get, you know, if you look at, say, an artist's career, say Picasso, going through different periods. I'm not a Picasso, by the way. But going through different periods, because different things excited him, or he was pushing himself in different ways, you know, the blue period, or, you know, I don't know, cubism. You have just seen the extent of my art. I have not started my research yet. But my point is that you want to find new ways to express yourself, find new ways to push a story, that mm-hmm. a different way to tell a story. And sometimes that's a different world.
You're basically like the writer version of Taylor Swift, jumping through all her eras, you know?
That's better than a Picasso endorsement.
Oh my goodness. Now, if I could sell, like Taylor Swift can sell her tours, awesome.
Well, this podcast should be a good launch.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
People who have left these episodes,
their
careers.
Taylor Swift on years ago, yeah. And now we're here.
Before, to jump, you said something that's interesting. Do you think you have to like to read to be a good writer?
I think you do. For a few reasons. Number one, I think it's really important to learn how to break down story. Like, at some point, yes, please read like a writer. Learn how the greats structured their stories. But then read like a reader and just enjoy the story. But I also think there are changes in how stories are written. I mean, if you think about back in, say, the Bronte era of that really emotive, you know, first person, and that was groundbreaking at the time. And then you move on and you've got a Hemingway, not emotive at all, a little more sparse in the language. And now you've got sort of in between and going different ways. It's important to know how writers are writing, what the marketplace is expecting from you as a writer, because bottom line, you want to sell your stories. But it's really fun to see how writers create their sentences, structure their worlds. And movies, you cannot capture it in the same way.
I agree. You gotta read. The book is always better. Yeah. So, Catherine, there's so many students at Notre Dame who are listening to this and would love to become writers of their own one day. So, simply put, what advice would you give them? How do you become a writer out of college? Is it possible?
It's absolutely possible. It was not my journey, but it is absolutely possible. Look at Veronica Roth, came out of Northwestern with Divergent. Boom.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yes. In fact, I believe she wrote Divergent within her final year at Northwestern within the creative writing program. Anyway, so yes, it's absolutely possible. But if that isn't one's path, that doesn't mean it isn't going to happen. I think the number one thing I'd say for a writer is simply don't give up. You are called to be a writer for a reason. You love it. You love the craft. You love the journey. Keep pursuing it. Your ability to affect the outcome, to control the outcome, pretty negligible. But your ability to affect how you feel about the journey and your enjoyment of it, that's in your control. So keep at it, enjoy it, have fun. And not only that, but in publishing, the different avenues for publication open continually every single day. Like, that is an industry in tremendous flux. So
that's amazing.
Keep at it.
So if you feel the call to writing, keep at it.
And you'll be meeting with some students from the creative writing class here after this for coffee. And I think they all need to hear that. One of them is actually on our student board. He's our newsletter guy, and he's going to, I think, get a lot of value out of that. So
he is so excited.
He's super pumped.
Oh, that's so fun. Good. Okay, that makes me happy.
Well, Catherine, this time with you has been so fun, and I can't thank you enough. We have now reached our final segment of the show, where we ask you three rapid-fire questions to get some off-the-cuff responses.
And this part takes like 20 minutes, so don't feel like every time we say rapid-fire.
We always say this, and then
this is part two of the episode.
Yeah, basically. So we have, Jared has affectionately named the segment The Fast Three with Jared and Lucy, even though it's not fast, and it usually leads to a lot more follow-up questions.
My next co-host needs to have a E sounding end of her name so that this works. So I have the first question. You've told us that writing as a job has not changed your passion for it. How is that possible?
Okay, so it ebbs and flows, you know, just like any job. I will tell you, when a deadline is coming up and it feels like a slog, then I might be a little bit grumpy. But then that new story idea, it's honestly like the first day of school, and kids may not know this anymore, but we've got those great pencils that are all sharpened and ready to go, and it's everything's new and everything's bright, and I'm excited again. So it ebbs and flows like any job, but I still love it. Absolutely still love it. In fact, as I just put this last sort of book to bed, and I'm playing with this new idea, it's like tingling in my fingers. I'm so excited about it.
So, awesome.
Yeah.
So you've given us a lot of advice on what college students should do. What is some advice that college students should ignore?
Oh, okay. So I would say, that's so interesting, ignore. Ignore anybody tells you you have to know what you're doing right now for the rest of your life. I mean, if you think about it, in the world today, you will probably be working until you're 70 years old because we're living longer,
right,
and you need an income. So that means 50 years.
Wow.
You are not going to be doing one thing. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. So hopefully you'll be doing several different things and enjoying them all and contributing to society with all of them. So you don't need to know. And another thing I would say, and this is advice rather than opposite of advice, take a deep breath. I think the podcast is titled You're Probably Gonna Be Okay.
Yeah. You're probably okay.
Okay, you're definitely okay.
We should change it.
Next season.
Exactly.
Okay, you're definitely
you're
okay.
You're definitely okay. Yeah. Take a deep breath because it's a long road. You're going to enjoy the road, and it's going to have twists and turns, most that you can't expect. Boy, I did not answer your question well
at
all.
No, that was good.
This is a tough part. We're tough with these questions. I think you did a great job.
Oh.
But you said a great quote a few weeks ago that reminded me of when you said life is a long time.
It's a long period. There you go. Yeah. Period. Bum. Yeah. Life's a long time.
So let's keep on that advice track. My other question is, what bad advice do a lot of people get in your profession?
Oh, bad advice in my profession? I think there is a real pressure to produce faster. And that's bad advice in the sense that, yes, maybe you can put out a story, another book within 9 months, but what is the quality of that book? And I think you can really harm yourself with your sales, et cetera, if you try, you get on a treadmill and you go faster and faster and faster. You'll deplete yourself, and what you're doing is trying to grow an audience, not tick off an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that.
But to go off that, though, you've talked about getting an agent.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And if you do want to pursue traditional publishing, you do need to have an agent. And that is true. And here's some ways that I think are really good to find that. Reach out to writers. I mean, that's the thing. Anybody who writes to me, I will write them back. And they will say, how did you find your agent? And I will tell them exactly how I found my agent. If you also want to find an agent, go to the back of the books you love that you think your book, your manuscript would sit well next to. See who we authors are acknowledging. We always thank our agents.
Oh, that's a good tip.
Always.
Oh, that is a really good tip.
My agent's name is in the back of my book, and so it is with every single other author. Anyway, so that's one reason, one way. Another way is to go to conferences. At conferences is this little known thing where they have like speed dating with agents and editors, and you can get in with an editor, pitch your story. You can get in with agents, pitch your story. And there you're getting past the slush pile, the sort of anonymous query letter that you need to send. But in traditional publishing, you do need an agent. And in self-publishing and boutique, you don't necessarily. So that's another thing. One has to sort of figure out where they want to go down that road. And that's not to say you can't do both. You can't do hybrid publishing.
These are all new terms for me.
This is good. This is why people tune in for the insider tips.
So why do you think it's important for this world to have great writers?
Oh, on so many levels. Okay, so number one, if we're talking fiction, great writing is a door into humanity. I think we could all use, I think Jamie Ford, I was interviewing him recently for a podcast, and he said that his most recent novel, The Many Daughters of Afong Moy, was to inoculate people with empathy. I thought that was a great way to say it. But fiction increases empathy. Like, it's proven. You enter into the human experience. And I think we need great stories, great writing, to expand our horizons, to step in each other's shoes for a little bit, to walk roads that we don't normally walk, or roads that are inaccessible to us to walk. So I think it's really important. And I think great writing, your brain changes when you read great writing. There was a study that showed that when people read Jane Austen, their brain like expanded in different spheres, their blood pressure lowered. It was just good for them.
Wow.
No, it's like it has a physical, you know, implication or consequence or, you know, whatever for you when you read. And so I just think it's really important that we writers stretch, we continue to produce great stories, and hopefully people keep reading them.
I love that message.
Yeah.
Fiction increases empathy.
I didn't know that happened.
It does.
Okay, so the pressure of making money in this, right? With
yeah,
this being
exactly.
A living. So do you write what you like, or do you write what you think people are going to like?
You know, it's a little bit of both. I absolutely write what I like, because it is very hard to spend a year and a half, two, three, with a story that you don't like that is just for the market. And if you do that, it is not going to have the depth anyway. So probably a bad idea. Now, that said, you need to follow the market to a degree. For instance, World War II stories, readers are still enjoying them. publishers are shying away from them because that has been a massive bubble since 2015, and they think it's probably going to slow down. Not only that, but the houses already have their big names, their big New York Times bestseller list writers who are writing in the World War II space. If you're starting out and writing a new novel, you're probably not going to crack into that space. So pick a different time period. So that is a little bit of writing into the market. Now that said, say you want to write a story about the agony of war, pick a different war, but you can still write what you want to write. Just look at the market and, you know, kind of pay attention to trends a bit. Also said, though, when you start a story, it's probably not going to be published for 2 to 3 years. Even when I hand in a story, I hand in a manuscript a full year before it's published. So there is a bit of anticipating.
All right. So speaking of handing in manuscripts, what are you most excited about right now professionally?
This new story I'm writing. Well, because as I said, that's what I can control. Now, that said, I have loved this summer. I was on the road doing book tour for Shadow in Moscow, which was the book that published in June. And I've loved that. And I've loved how well received this novel is, because for me, these two characters came to life. And, you know, it takes place in 1980s, primarily 1980s Moscow. So it's not exactly a light, effervescent story, but it's really resonating with readers. And I love that because I loved writing it. And it's really nice when that connection follows through, you know, from writer to reader. So I'm loving that. I'm loving the new story I'm creating. And I'm really excited, actually, about the Berlin Letters, which will come out in March, because that was a very different writing experience for me. I had to write it fairly quickly, and so it was a more intense experience, which kind of changed up my writing process. But I discovered aspects of that more intense experience that really helped push the story forward, pushed me out of my comfort zone. And so I think I will now self-impose those same restrictions on myself, because it created some really good nuggets that I don't think I would, I think I would have held back had I not been in this, you have to write this story quickly, panic mode.
Yeah. So are you, I know you mentioned earlier that you're switching into art. Is that transition happening now, or is that something we can expect in the future?
It's happening now, but as I said, it'll probably take me about a year and a half to write it. I'll hand it in a year before it's published. So the reader won't really see that book until minimum 2025. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Have you ever heard one of your fans, I'm sure you have now at this point, a pretty big following. Have you ever heard a fan say, I didn't like that one? Like, does that hurt you? Do you care? Like,
But here's the thing. Go on Goodreads and you can find plenty of reviews that say, I didn't like that one. Huh. I mean, I have one review for a book, and I'm not going to tell you which one. I think she spent more time writing the review than I did the book. And it was an eviscerating review. But she really studied the book to you know, malign it so precisely. That's something, quite frankly, you have to be really aware of as a writer. And I'm very careful about that. I think Elizabeth Gilbert actually did a TED talk on this, and it was brilliant. She said, you know, after Eat, Pray, Love, she went into this panic because nobody, it's not wanted her to succeed, but almost no one thought she could, in the sense that what book was going to be as big as Eat, Pray, Love? Or was it going to be complete failure? And she said she really couldn't get to writing again until she went to that middle ground where she realized why she wrote and had to sort of silence voices on both spectrums. Because if you believe all the hype, then you also open yourself to believe all the negative. And the negative can be really harsh.
Yeah.
So when the hype can be really nice too, but you got to be careful.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for being with us here today. I speak for all the students when I say this has been an incredibly motivating conversation, and we are so fortunate that you are now part of the Notre Dame family.
Thank you.
Welcome. I'd love to hear about what's next for you. So how can we help you achieve your goals?
Oh, goodness. Okay, so you can follow me on social media because that's always fun. Writers can always write to me, as I said, and you can reach out on my website. But if you read one of my books, I would love it if you'd review it. That actually means a ton for authors to have books reviewed on, I mean, even if you don't buy your books on Amazon, it's a huge search engine. Mm-hmm. So on Amazon, on Goodreads, on BookBub, and I'm sure there are more out there, but I'm showing my age there. Amazon, Book Reads.
Book Talk.
Yeah, Book Talk. But that would be wonderful. I would really appreciate that.
Of course. Well, you heard it here. Everyone go comment your thoughts.
Comment, write reviews, follow. All right, we will, and we're going to be, because you're going to start following Beyond the Dome, so we got to repay the favor.
Yeah, there you go.
Exciting. Hey, thanks a lot. This has been awesome. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Really,
Thank
really
you.
Enjoyed
this
it.
This was amazing.